children as young as 14 years old to work overnight shifts, even on school days. The bill would also eliminate working time restrictions on 14 and 15-year-olds if they are homeschooled and end guaranteed meal breaks for 16 and 17-year-olds. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. I want to start warm up a bit with a great speech that Susan Sarandon had delivered last week as a new phase of the attack on Gaza, of the Holocaust of Gaza begins. Let's listen.
It's really a thrill. And I mourn for those who have been quiet during this televised genocide, because their loss is greater than death. Theirs is the loss of compassion and a shared humanity. And what is happening now here that makes it possible to happen, what is happening in Palestine, cannot ever be normalized, and that's why we're here tonight. Caitlin Johnstone said, in quote, "Now the Gaza Holocaust has been reignited, and the people who rule over us actively supporting this while working to imprison, fire, silence, and deport anyone who opposes it. Please understand that this is personal now. This isn't only about some strangers in the Middle East. It's also about you. It's about your rights. It's about your freedom to speak out against the criminality of your rulers. It's about the kind of society you want to live in. It's about the kind of future that you want for your children. We are not separate from what's happening in Gaza. As hard as we might try to make ourselves feel that way, Gaza is here. The waves of blood are lapping at your doorstep. The dead and mutilated children are strewn about your living room and kitchen. They were placed there by the powerful people who run your government and its allies. There's no getting away from it. Gaza has been brought right to you and laid at your feet. And now it's up to you how you're going to respond to it," unquote. Alana said that we're tired. A lot of you are tired. We all get tired. And it's possible to get discouraged, but we don't have the luxury to be depressed. And I'm probably going to cry when I read this, because I do every time. I take out my Howard Zinn. I hope most of you know who Howard Zinn is. And this is something that I keep with me at all times. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory.
That was Susan Sarandon. And I have an intro for the next segment, which I will play now.
Engaged is really a thrill. And I mourn for those who have been quiet during this televised genocide, because their loss is greater than death. Theirs is the law.
Good afternoon. This is Zain El-Amin with the Shy of Nana show. You just heard a woman that I adore and respect because of her stance on genocide and recognizing it as what it is, which is a Holocaust of the Palestinian people. And she refers to it as such. This was, of course, the famous actress Susan Sarandon, who basically risked her career to tell the truth while others cowered in Hollywood, of course. We have a situation right now where in Hollywood, the magazine, basically the trade magazine, is Variety, and recently on March 21st, when Snow White was released, the lead actress had actually, after being lauded and appreciated by critics, calling her the only good thing about the movie. And this is really interesting because Gal Gadot, who plays the evil sorceress, basically, in Snow White, is an IDF soldier, but the lead actress of Snow White is pro-Palestinian, and she basically put out a statement to free Palestine. And what got her in trouble with the Variety magazine, which released a hit, basically a hit piece, which actually reads like praise for those progressives and humanitarians. But anyway, that's what Susan Sarandon has risked by standing on the right side of history. She knows that she was going to lose her agent. She was going to lose her agency. She was going to lose any leading roles. Anyway, Hollywood doesn't respect any woman over 40 very much, but even this makes it even worse. But these are words to live by. On other news, there are actions now to hold the line at Mahmoud Khalil. As you know, Mahmoud Khalil is the Columbia student that has been sent to the notorious detention center in Louisiana, along with several others. And people are aware, some people at least are aware, that this is just a testing ground. They're trying to use a kind of law from the 50s to the Secretary of State can use to basically snuff out free speech. If you think you're immune, if you think, you know, doesn't relate to you, of course, you'll find out it's testing ground. And we saw what's coming next. You know, it's not just the Middle East Department at Columbia University that they want to put in receivership, which means that actually Trump ghouls will be monitoring what we teach basically at Columbia, what they teach at Columbia University. But also they put the African Studies Department in receivership. And if you don't hold the line at Mahmoud Khalil, if you don't stop that deportation, they'll succeed. They'll know that it's okay to go after everything, whether it's African Studies, whether it's Gender Studies Department, and then they'll expand out, which they've already started, into the public at large. But they'll expand in a speedy way, let's put it that way, to attack free speech in general. And we'll talk more about that later when we listen to a piece by Electronic Intifada about who is at the heart of all of this, who's at the heart of the attack on free speech domestically and internationally. There needs to be, right now, Baltimore has set the example for what needs to be done. We're seeing across the nation these rallies, these record-breaking rallies that Bernie Sanders and AOC have been holding. They're even breaking the record, their own records, of the rallies that Bernie did while he was running for the presidency before the Democratic Department committed an étude Bernie that was coordinated by Obama and basically did a character assassination and deposed him basically from the elections and put the cottage cheese for brains, Biden. These record-breaking, I'm seeing a lot of sectarianism. There's no time for sectarianism right now or partisanship. We know what's at stake. There's an urgency. I know you feel it. And people who are referring to the left as dirtbag left, and then people are referring to these liberals that are attending the rallies. There doesn't need to be. We need to have a united front at this time and stop name calling. This is not an endorsement. I've clarified this to friends and allies. This is not, if you are celebrating these rallies, it's not because you endorse Bernie Sanders and AOC, who both, by the way, to different degrees, betrayed us on Palestine. And notice that they don't use the word Palestine, and they blame everything on Netanyahu. About Netanyahu. This is about the state of Israel. And the reason why it's really dangerous to blame everything on Netanyahu is because when Netanyahu's gone, if he's ever gone, then there's a legitimacy that will be placed on Israel that would allow it to continue the genocidal work that's doing to a different degree. So I know the critiques, but you have to celebrate this gathering, because it means this gathering are people that are unemployed, that are being kicked out, that are their Medicaid and Social Security are under siege, their retirement funds are being sloughed by half or even whatever they saved, even if they've invested in big companies, they're losing money, they're losing all the benefits, and basically the Social Security or the social safety network is being shredded. These people are coming and looking for answers, and this is not the time to boohoo these people and criticize them because they're showing up for these rallies. This is the time to gather, and to gather our emergency response teams, just like Baltimore just did. They made a call for emergency response network to be formed, and they filled up the gathering space, which had the capacity of 250 people, and it's that's a quite a fiery start for a network. In the same sense, we need to have emergency response networks for the DMV area, for DC, Maryland, and Virginia. As you know, many of the laid off federal workers and such are not necessarily living in DC, but working in DC and living in Maryland and in Virginia. So there needs to be a call for that. And I'll be working and seeing what who is interested in that. And what groups that are already formed that are interested in that. That's the work at hand. That's what's to be done now. Also, you know, this will work in conjunction with the incompetence of the Trump presidency, which we've seen this administration in the recent debacle, where high-ranking members of the administration somehow put an Atlantic reporter, who, by the way, is part of the Israeli Defense Force at one point. They basically shared their war plans for to attack Yemen while not knowing that there's a journalist online. This is the kind of incompetent moves that they're going to make, and that's going to be their downfall. But it can't be their downfall if there's not an alternative being posed, if there's not a strong grassroots movement that's confronting and exposing these things. So who is funding this attack on free speech nationally and internationally? Who's funding this attack on democracy? Of course, for those of you who have been following things, who followed the campaign, know that Marian Adelson, the Adelson family, is the one that's the biggest funder of the Trump campaign, and it's the biggest funder to the Republican Party. And it is her work that has required, you know, she had been posting about Mahmoud Khalil, and she is the one directly responsible. She's the one that's coordinating this and pointing, meaning naming names, as they used to say back under McCarthyism in the 50s, naming names that she doesn't like and having, ordering Trump to remove those people, and that's what's at stake right now. This is who's controlling free speech here, and it's not about the destruction of free speech by Marian Adelson in the United States. It's about the fascists and the growing right wing all over Europe, for example, that are looking to this and seeing what Trump can get away with and applying the same. So this is not just a threat to free speech in America. This is a threat to free speech and democracy, and something that feeds the right, the rise of the right, and the rise of white supremacy worldwide. That's what's at stake right now. And with that, I would like to introduce the piece that Electronic Intifada did on this very subject. So let's have a listen.
You are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, here with my colleague Ali Abunima. Quote, "My name is Mahmoud Khalil, and I am a political prisoner. I'm writing to you from a detention facility in Louisiana, where I wake to cold mornings and spend long days bearing witness to the quiet injustices underway against a great many people precluded from the protections of the law." That's what the Columbia University graduate and student leader said in a letter dictated from the prison where he is still being held more than 10 days after U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested him from the university-owned apartment building where he lives in New York City on March 8th. Khalil adds, "My arrest was a direct consequence of exercising my right to free speech as I advocated for a free Palestine and an end to the genocide in Gaza, which resumed in full force Monday night. With January's ceasefire now broken, parents in Gaza are once again cradling two small shrouds, and families are forced to weigh starvation and displacement against bombs. It is our moral imperative to persist in the struggle for their complete freedom. The government's crackdown, the government's attempt to deport Khalil, which he is challenging in court, is part of an aggressive crackdown by the Trump administration targeting supporters of Palestinian rights. This morning, news broke that Badar Khansouri, a postdoctoral scholar at Georgetown University and a citizen of India, was arrested Monday night outside of his Virginia home by officers who identified themselves as Department of Homeland Security agents. According to his attorney, Suri was targeted because of his wife's, quote, identity as a Palestinian and her constitutionally protected speech. This week, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of students Momodou Tal and Sriram Parasurma and Professor Mukoma Wa Ngugi, whose activism in support of Palestine has put them at serious risk of political persecution. The lawsuit seeks a nationwide injunction to halt the administration's efforts to target and deport international students like these plaintiffs and Mahmoud Khalil. According to Eli Clifton, our next guest, the Trump administration's unprecedented decision to seek the deportation of Khalil, a U.S. permanent resident, without bringing any criminal charges, has an overlooked ally. She is Miriam Adelson, the Israeli-American billionaire who is the largest financer of Trump's three presidential campaigns. Eli Clifton is a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute. He just wrote the article, "The Israeli-American Trump Mega Donor Behind Speech Crackdowns for Responsible Statecraft," the publication where he is investigative journalist at large. He joins us now to talk more about Miriam Adelson's role. Welcome, Eli.
Thank you for having me.
It's really good to have you. And if you could just start by reminding us quickly who Miriam Adelson is and who her late husband Sheldon Adelson was. Where did they get their money from? And in broad terms, how have the Adelson family been using this money in recent years?
So the Adelson family, and specifically Sheldon Adelson, made billions of dollars, largely with his development of the Las Vegas Sands Corporation, which is a company based, as you might guess, in Las Vegas, Nevada. But it's important to keep that in mind, that owned at its peak, or certainly at the peak of its American presence, the Venetian Casino in Las Vegas. He's had sort of segued from running conventions in Las Vegas. The Comdex convention was something he helped spin up. And he turned this into a fortune worth, you know, in excess of $30 billion, which is now, while it is still called the Las Vegas Sands Corporation, it really isn't in any sense connected to Las Vegas other than being based there. What it really is an Asian gaming company. Most of their casinos are in Macau, a special administrative region of China, and they have a casino in Singapore, the Marina Bay. But that doesn't mean that they have family. Sheldon Adelson died in 2021, but that his family, now led by his wife, Miriam Adelson, are any less active in American politics. If anything, they've scaled up their involvement. Miriam Adelson was born in Israel. She's an Israeli-American, dual national. And that gets thrown around a lot, I should say, especially in circles where people are concerned about the influence of Israel, claiming that people are dual nationals, where in some cases they are not. And I think it's a dangerous thing to use that label when you can't prove it. It's in SEC filings. It's established that she holds dual citizenship. And the Adelsons themselves have been, I think a lot of donors in the political space are very coy about what they want and who they are and why they give money. I think that's a bad thing. And I think the Adelsons, to their credit, certainly when Sheldon was alive and going on now with Miriam, are very outspoken about that their primary interest in being the largest donors to the Republican Party, is really focused on Israel, that is their first and foremost concern, maintaining zero daylight between U.S. administrations and Israel, is really the most important thing to them, and the thing that they take a great deal of pride in their philanthropy, as well as in their political donations. So I think that sort of sums up her role. She's time and time again, Miriam Adelson, and she's become more public since Sheldon's death in 2021. He used to speak for them more than she did. But it's very clear that she holds, if anything, views probably more hawkish into the right of where he was in terms of what she thinks U.S. policy in the Middle East should be. And the fact that she sees Trump as sort of serving sort of a biblical function in defending Israel, which is kind of striking, again, coming from the person who has overseen the most political contributions going to Trump's entire political career, openly has written that she sees him, and the reason that she loves him so much isn't because of any of his domestic agenda or politics. It's really about his support for Israel, something that he delivered on in enormous ways in his first term, and that she regularly brings up. And that included delivering on the Golan Heights, abrogating from the US, from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, and moving the US embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Something that, again, they had talked about quite a bit, as the family had wanted. And sort of the final step in that was that the Trump administration, this is the first Trump administration, wanted to make sure that whoever came next wouldn't be able to so easily move the embassy back to Tel Aviv. And the way that one of the steps they took was to sell the ambassador's home in Tel Aviv, and they sold it to the Adelson family. So that sort of tells you about what these people want, why they give their money, and again, they're very open about it.
Mm. And of course, Sheldon Adelson, who was U.S.-born, an American citizen, famously said at one point that he'd served in the U.S. military during World War II, I believe, and he said he regretted that he had served in the U.S. military and not the Israeli military. So that gives you a sense of where they're loyalties and priorities lie. But in your article for Responsible Statecraft, you write that tax documents reveal that Miriam Adelson is directly overseeing a social media campaign targeting Mahmoud Khalil and Columbia University through something called the Maccabee Task Force. I'll ask you, you could talk about what the Maccabee Task Force is and how it has been involved in the Trump campaign, but also what is Miriam Adelson's role in it?
I would just add, I don't think it was World War II. He was old, he wasn't that old.
It might have been, you may be right about that.
He did serve, though, and he did make those comments, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what the Maccabee Task Force is something that was started in 2015 with a pretty modest donation from the Adelson family. They donated a little bit over $2 million to an organization that was going to be focused on college campuses. And they, quote, said it was to combat disturbing spread of anti-Semitism on college campuses. But they were pretty clear, again, from the launch, what that really meant. And they said that it really was focusing on rolling back the perceived successes of the boycott, divest, and sanctions, the BDS campaigns against Israel. Which Maccabee Task Force characterizes as, quote, an anti-Semitic movement that crosses the line from legitimate criticism of Israel into the dangerous demonization of Israel and its supporters. So again, they're pretty upfront about what they were doing, why they were doing it, what the motivation was. And Maccabee Task Force, it really scaled up. And eventually they brought over David Brog, who was the head of Christians United for Israel. He came over to run it. And really it started with that modest contribution, between when they launched and 2023, the last year that there are publicly available tax filings for the group, the Adelsons had put in nearly $70 million into it. And again, this is happening alongside, and I think this is meaningful, the Adelsons being the largest donors to Trump's political career, as well as to the Republican Party, to congressional races, to gubernatorial races. They are the biggest donors. Elon Musk might be challenging them on that right now, But again, when you look past back several cycles, they've put in nearly $600 million in reported political contributions. That's not dark money that they might be putting in also. So these guys are very meaningful political, political donors. And the Maccabee Task Force, springs to life with the college campus protests about Israel's war in Gaza. Partially because it's very much in their wheelhouse. This is what they were designed for, was to push back. And I think, again, credit where credit is due, I think Maccabee Task Force pretty accurately identified back in 2015 that college campuses and the next generation and young people and academics were probably going to be on the forefront of challenging the unconditional U.S. support for Israel. And indeed, they were clearly right as the protests about the war in Gaza scaled up, particularly at Columbia University, which had become the poster child for it. And that's where Maccabee Task Force, again, looking at their social media posts, which I sort of looked at, really the more recent ones even, although I know they've been very active over the past couple of years, had been focusing their efforts, was to say that what went on at Columbia went beyond what is acceptable speech, that it went beyond certainly the rules of what the university abides by, that it went beyond what the federal government should be allowing any federal funds to go towards supporting. All things which ultimately the Trump administration chose to follow up on with Columbia University, with the arrest and attempted deportation of Mahmoud Khalil. But this, we can talk about what those social media posts said and the fact that they went after Khalil in ways that when I reached out to Maccabee Task Force, they chose not to respond. Since this, I asked them, do you have evidence? You said you called him a Hamas supporter. You said he came to the U.S. to promote chaos and destruction. These are pretty close to saying that he was providing material support for terrorism, which is indeed a felony. A felony he was not charged with. Maccabee Task Force chose not to respond to those questions. But to bring us back to Miriam Adelson and why this is particularly notable, Maccabee Task Force website lists out who their staff are, lists out David Brog and his involvement in his leadership of the group, lists out a lot of their staff. But it doesn't list who their president is, the head of the organization. And that's only in IRS tax documents that Maccabee Task Force has to file each year. And what that reveals is that Miriam Adelson isn't just their biggest donor. She's also the president of the group. So she's, Donald Trump's biggest donor, biggest supporter, the biggest supporter of the Republican Party, is actually in the leadership, the leader of a very outspoken group targeting individual students on college campuses, cheering on attempts to deport them, making unsubstantiated claims that would suggest that they are providing material support to Hamas. And that, I think, is a pretty potent cocktail of power and money and political influence.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's, Maccabee is one of, as you mentioned, several well-funded groups like this that have been operating on college campuses for decades, spying on students and faculty, trying to develop relationships with or have developed relationships with lawmakers, both local and national, and threatening students' families, and now trying to get people deported for having an opinion, a political opinion. Can you talk about specifically the Mahmoud Khalil case in this context, and what the Maccabee Task Force has specifically done to try and throw everything they can at Mahmoud Khalil and the precedent that it sets and what they're trying to do in that case?
Well, they didn't just go after it. Certainly a lot of their social media posts over the past several weeks have been a combination of cheering on the effort, the detainment and efforts to deport Khalil, but also swinging at Columbia University and cheering on the defunding of Columbia University by the Trump administration. And I would say, like, it borders line into just sort of crass social media posts. They have an enormous following on Facebook, over 300,000 followers. And, you know, one of their posts said, you know, sad truth is that the administration at Columbia couldn't even be bothered to pretend to care about the safety of Jewish students until the White House threatened the prospect of losing $5 billion. And so they're making wild claims against Columbia University and cheering on the defunding. When it came to Mahmoud Khalil, they claimed he was a Hamas supporter. Again, couldn't provide any evidence. They said that deporting Khalil after wreaking havoc at Columbia University campus is a positive step in the right direction. And they claimed, again, without providing any evidence, that Khalil came to the U.S. to promote chaos and destruction. These are pretty, again, pretty extreme claims against somebody when there are no criminal charges that have actually been filed. And one thing I do want to point to with their social media campaign and this targeting of an American university and targeting of an American permanent resident, Mahmoud Khalil, in such specific and again, throwing out these unsubstantiated claims against both Khalil and Columbia, are that when you go in and you look closely at the Facebook page for McAfee Task Force and you look at who manages it, they have something called the page transparency on Facebook that will not give you specifics about who the managers of the page are, but it will tell you sort of some basic information, such as how many people they are and where in the world they are. And what that revealed was that two out of the seven managers of the Facebook page are based in Israel. And again, I think that's a pretty, you know, we need to stop and reflect on that for a moment, that there are individuals in Israel managing what is supposed to be an organization focused on American college campuses, largely comprised supposedly of American college students, that is singling out both students and universities for unsubstantiated vitriolic attacks because of efforts to what I could only describe as an effort to stifle free speech about American foreign policy towards Israel. That's pretty scary that folks in Israel are involved in actively trying to make an example out of American permanent residents and American universities for daring to permit or to engage in constitutionally protected speech critiquing American foreign policy.
And that's really, I thought, a really significant thing that you found and is in your article at Responsible Statecraft. And it reminds me of the revelations that were in Al Jazeera's documentary, The Lobby USA, which, of course, Al Jazeera, certainly after a pressure campaign from the lobby, never broadcast, ironically. The Israel lobby didn't want a documentary about the lobby broadcast because they said it's full of lies and the lobby doesn't have any real power. And that same lobby managed to get Qatar somehow not to broadcast or to pressure Al Jazeera not to broadcast the documentary. But in 2018, this was in 2018, the Electronic Intifada obtained copies of the documentary, and we published them. In fact, you can find them on our YouTube channel. But one of the key things that documentary revealed was how the Israeli government was directly directing and coordinating the campaign to suppress speech on American campuses. This was done through something called the Ministry of Strategic Affairs that was working directly with US-based groups, including the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a far-right neocon group that whose main job, it seems to be, is to advocate for war with Iran, and other groups like that, the Israel on Campus Coalition, and so on. In terms of sort of bringing it back to what's happening now with the crackdown, I reported last week on another extreme Zionist organization called Betar USA and how it has been identifying and inciting against individual students, including Mahmoud Khalil, that it wants to see deported. Betar even brags about compiling dossiers about students and passing them on to the Trump administration. Do you have a sense of how coordinated these types of efforts are now and how much collusion there is between the U.S. government and these extreme pro-Palestinian groups, whether it's the Maccabi Task Force or Betar or any others. Do we know more about that than we learned, say, in the Al Jazeera documentary?
I mean, look, I think what you're certainly seeing is an echoing of talking points and accusations, both back and forth between the U.S. government and these groups. And it cycles back and forth. The thing that I find the most concerning about these groups, and maybe Maccabi Task Force, again, is the exception rather than the rule here, is how most of them actively conceal who is behind them. that these are groups that have now taken the steps of cheering on, frankly, what is going to turn into, you know, a severe challenge to the First Amendment. I hope the courts will rule that that indeed this is protected political speech and you can't target a U.S. permanent resident for engaging in this sort of speech. But that is where we are at. And these groups are cheering it on, and they're doing it largely while concealing who they are and who's behind it. And in the case of turning back to Maccabi Task Force, the fact that they are tied to the president's biggest donor, the fact that they are tied to somebody who is very clear that they are engaged in a transactional relationship with Donald Trump when it comes to Israel, and is doing so with a huge amount of wealth and power at their disposal, is really scary. And you add into that the fact that it's not just that they are very much identify as being Israeli and are indeed an Israeli citizen, but the fact that the actual that person is the president of Maccabi Task Force, but there's that added element that the actual nuts and bolts of this campaign targeting, again, U.S. permanent residents, targeting entire institutions like Columbia University, are actually being executed and orchestrated by people in Israel. That's what we are seeing from that page, transparency of their Facebook page. And I think that what that really brings home, to sort of zoom out, and I see up in the corner, it's day 531 of the war in Gaza, is to start to think about the fact that we mostly talk about the cost of this war in terms of American credibility in the world, American ability to talk about human rights when we're complicit in this war that's taken tens of thousands of civilian, innocent civilian lives. And we talk about the monetary cost, which is also real, that the United States, through what it provides to Israel in support. But this is starting to show another cost. There's another cost of this war that is coming home, which is that the support for the war is going down. The Gallup poll from earlier this month said that less than half of people in the U.S. now are sympathetic towards the Israelis in this war. It's been a slow but steady decline in support for Israel's war in Gaza. So the steps that the people that want to maintain U.S. support for it are going to have to undertake is going to get more extreme. And that's what we're starting to see now. It's starting to impose real costs. It's starting to challenge what we consider to be, core American values and rights, our civil liberties, our ability to dissent, our ability to challenge U.S. foreign policy, to challenge any government policy, not just foreign policy, to take what we take for granted, which is that we should be able to question the United States' relationship with any country in the world, not just Israel, that this is constitutionally protected and that it's culturally part of who we are. Groups like Maccabi Task Force, groups like Betar, groups like Canary Mission, they don't want that. They want to stifle that form of speech. And that's coming at a very real cost. Columbia is looking at, being defunded by billions of dollars. Khalil is looking at being deported. It's something that is a real cost. Badr Khansouri at Georgetown is looking at potentially being deported for his wife's statements. It's just incredible to think the challenges that are being put up towards what we consider to be protected forms of speech inside this country. And that is a cost of this war, and a cost that I think now we are starting to have to pay, because, again, public support continues to decline. So they're going to have to use more and more coercive methods to maintain the status quo.
And those are such important points. And it's something that's been going on for years, and people tend to exceptionalize Trump because he's taking it further than others have before. But it's important to remember that the demonization of free speech about Palestine has been going on for years under Democratic and Republican administrations and from Democratic and Republican members of Congress. And since we mentioned it, I just want to show people, because we have many people who are coming to this issue new, the documentary, the Al Jazeera documentary, which you can find at the Electronic Intifada on our YouTube channel, or if you search just on a search engine, watch the film The Israel Lobby Didn't Want You to See, you will be able to watch that censored documentary revealing direct Israeli government intervention in efforts to stop free speech, particularly on American campuses. I just wanted to mention that. And Eli, we're very grateful to you for your time today. And just to remind people that you are a researcher at the Quincy Institute, and you are an investigative journalist. I've been following your work for many years. You have a particular interest and knack in pulling out really important facts from very boring tax filings. And I've learned a lot from you in doing that.
Oh, they're terribly
it's a skill.
but you know, that's where the secrets are buried, so that's to right. speak. And you and your article in Responsible Statecraft, the Israeli-American Trump mega donor behind speech crackdown, is really important reading. And thank you for coming on to talk about it today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eli.
That was the Electronic Intifada, Ali Abu Nima and Nora Boris Friedman interviewing a scholar, or rather a writer for the Quincy Institute, about the article that he had just written about who's dismantling your free speech. You know, an Israeli citizen is funding Trump. She's the biggest funder of Trump. Her family is the biggest funder of the Republican Party. Your freedom of speech is being attacked by a foreign agent, basically. And again, as I mentioned before, and I want to be mentioning again, this is an attack on free speech and democracy. For those, you know, liberals and Democrats that were warning about the dismantling of democracy, that's, you know, that's where the fight is. That's where the front line is. And I want to say something. I'm going to get a little personal here. You know, yesterday when I moved, to Columbia Heights neighborhood in Washington, D.C., you know, about 22 years ago, there was such poverty, and the biggest the crime was happening at the interface of what I called desperation and gentrification, not within communities that were in, intact, meaning communities that were poor but still accountable to each other. It's when those communities were shredded that we saw crime and an increase in crime. And it's when those social safety networks were shredded, that's where we saw more what is referred to as criminal activity. And the solution was not policing. The solution was sewing back that net, that social safety net. Yesterday, in my housing co-op of Ella Jo Baker, there was a fight right outside, a shootout that has happened throughout the history of Columbia Heights, and a bullet entered my hallway window, and fortunately nobody was in its path. That's the state of things in the capital of the United States. And this scapegoating of immigrants, this scapegoating of Palestinians, this scapegoating by a foreign agent is to distract you from these issues, from these life and death issues. Violence that is being done by the United States, it is destroying everything good in this world. There is no, I can't gentle this. Everything good, everything that is beautiful in this world is being destroyed by the United States government. And my dream is that every single embassy in the Middle East, which will, that's a dream, will be shut down. Every boot, every military boot from the U.S. military should be wiped off of the any country that's meaning those soldiers should be sent home. They should be given Social Security, Medicaid, and post-traumatic stress treatment rather than cutting their benefits right now, as veterans around the country are rising up, even Republican veterans. I don't care if you're a redneck or a blue neck. They're rising up and demanding that, you know, what did we fight for? You know, now you're dismantling our veteran affairs benefits. So that's the state of things in Washington, D.C., for those of you who are listening nationwide and even internationally. It's a mess. It's a mess. But I wanted to say one thing, is that we are closer to winning than you might think. In my quarter of a century of activism in in the belly of the beast in Washington, D.C., every time that I was feeling, and we were feeling, or my community of activists were feeling that they were about to be defeated, that they're facing an existential issue, and that they're about to be defeated and eliminated, we won. So we are at what Bill Moyers had referred to as stage 4. And that's not like stage 4 of cancer, stage 4 cancer. This is stage 4 of fighting back. And as long as we carry it through, we can win. And the signs, what is on our side? Let's count our blessings. One is the Israeli economy is still collapsing. We've been reporting on this. Their sports team, one indication of they're losing the PR. Their sports team can't play anywhere without being given the red card, which is an international campaign. Their soldiers are being hunted down by organizations, not hunted down violently, but legally, by organizations worldwide. They have to hide their social media. They have to hide their identity. It's because if they're exposed by the by organizations like the Hind Rajah Project, they are pursued by the governments that are hosting them. The other thing is that the ICJ has carried its ruling further right now, not only declaring that Israel is committing human rights abuses, but Israel itself is an illegitimate state. Ireland just joined the ICJ. The corruption charges still stand against Netanyahu, and public opinion continues to turn against him, even though what we're hoping for is public opinion will turn against their own state, because it's bigger than the issue is bigger than Netanyahu. Our actions have made an impact on all of those things. So the last indication, and one important indication, and this is where the overlap between the people that are now standing up to fight against oligarchy are tapering nicely with the fight for Palestinian liberation, which is the boycott and divestment movement, which should be duplicated now by the people fighting oligarchy, because Palestine already demonstrated that boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS approach, does work, and we're seeing it, for example, in its impact on, for example, on the economic interests of Elon Musk. And we've never seen the billionaires stand buck naked as they stand right now. It's and spelling out what they're interested in, which is destroying the benefits for the poorest in the nation. And this is time to kick them in the bollocks, which, by the way, in the UK does not just indicate the testicles, but indicates its meaning is that it's nonsense and rubbish. Thank you, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Donald Trump signed a sweeping order yesterday seeking broad changes to how elections are run. Among its provisions, the order mandates changes to the federal voter registration form by requiring prospective voters to provide proof of citizenship, such as a U.S. passport or birth certificate. Voting rights advocates argue that it could disenfranchise millions of eligible voters who lack readily available proof of citizenship. The order also requires that all ballots must be received by Election Day, an attempt to override states that allow mail ballots that are postmarked by election date to be received afterward. It is unclear how enforceable the order is, given that the Constitution gives authority over elections to the states. In other news, Tulsi Gabbard, the National Intelligence Director, and John Ratcliffe, the head of the CIA, faced a grilling today by Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee. Both were part of a group chat about a military operation that included the top editor of The Atlantic. Today's hearing came just hours after The Atlantic published the full text of a signal group chat among senior administration national security officials, revealing that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth shared precise details of military operations against Yemen's Houthis. The chat logs indicate that Hegseth provided exact times of warplane launches, strike packages, and targets before the aircraft were airborne. Agreeing with previous statements from President Trump, Gabbard and Ratcliffe today continued to insist that no classified information was sent in the group chat, while Democrats cited executive orders and internal government guidance to argue that the operational details should have been considered highly classified. In news from Gaza, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warned today that the tight Israeli blockade on the entry of humanitarian supplies into the Gaza Strip is pushing the territory closer to an acute hunger crisis. Israel has banned the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza since March 4th. In a statement, the UNRWA director, Philip Lazzarini, said, quote, basic supplies are running out, and some will last only for a few more days unless aid shipments are allowed in, close quote. Lazzarini called for the siege to be lifted and for humanitarian aid and commercial supplies to be brought into Gaza uninterrupted and at scale. In other news, Florida's efforts to crack down on employers who hire undocumented immigrants have presented a problem for businesses who cannot find enough workers willing to fill low-wage and often undesirable jobs. To fix the problem, the state's legislature has advanced a bill that would loosen child labor laws. If passed, businesses would be able to hire children as young as 14 years old